El siguiente es un programa pagado por el anunciante y 1600 AM no se hace responsable por las opiniones reflejadas en su contenido.
This is a special program on Multicultural 1600 AM, so please stay tuned.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Welcome to All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlo Dermogradichian. I'd like to welcome you to another episode of All Things Armenian. Today, my guest is Jack Chavur, and Jack is a recent graduate of the Fresno State MFA program in creative writing, where he completed his thesis, a very interesting thesis entitled Ghosts of the Genocide. Welcome to All Things Armenian, Jack.
Thank you, Barlo. It's good to be here.
Thank you. Well, before we talk about the thesis, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about your background. Can you tell us a little bit about where you were born, where you grew up?
Certainly. I was born in Burbank, California, and grew up there, moved to Fresno in 1979. I was 26 at the time, got married a year later, and became an English teacher at Roosevelt High School. I was there for 30 years, and here I am.
Well, the
fast forward, what has it been, 6 years, 7 years, wow. I've been retired and decided to do something good with my retired, with the free time, and ended up in the MFA program at Fresno State.
Well, that's the interesting thing. So you were teaching English at Roosevelt. I happen to be a Roosevelt graduate myself, so I'm also
all right, go Riders.
That's
yeah.
It. We're Rough Riders for sure. What was the sort of turning point for you in terms of wanting to enter the MFA program, and what was in your mind your goal? What were you thinking of achieving? Why did you want to go into that?
Well, in the last 7 or 8 years before I retired, I began wondering what I was going to do, and I always imagined I would take one or two classes to keep my mind percolating and that sort of thing. I really didn't have it in mind to actually enter the program. And then, got an important note from my wife, so I had she says, speak louder. Okay. Megan Bohegan, a friend and former colleague at Roosevelt, began pestering me that I should enter the program. And I was a little uncertain about it. And then I finally decided I would. My wife said, you know, you've been writing all these stories. Maybe your homework is almost, you know, is done. You just turn in what you've written. Of course, that wasn't true, but so I decided to go for it. And what really cemented the deal was my oldest, my daughter Kathleen, on the first day of school at Fresno State, she had me stand on the porch and took my picture, as we had done for her for many years and the others. And so many times I thought, well, I can't, I have to go through with it now. I have my picture taken on the front porch starting school. I don't want it to be, well, he started, but he, you know, he crapped out. So that's how it happened.
And when you entered the program, what happens? What's the first process? I mean, you ended up obviously with the thesis that we're going to be talking about and that you're going to be reading excerpts, but what do you start with? Do you actually take courses, and at what point do you have to actually begin to write and to develop a thesis?
Well, you take writing workshop classes throughout. I think I took three or four workshops where you bring what you've written, and when it's your turn, your essay is read, has been read, and then you get evaluated by your peers and by the professor. In the first semester, I was quite mortified. My colleagues were very, very good writers, everybody in the program. I have to say, and no one slipped me $20 to say this, Fresno State has one of the finest MFA programs in the country. And the reason I say that is, you know, we have a literary magazine, The Normal School is the name of it. And for a couple of semesters, I read submissions from all around the country for the magazine. And let's just say, with very few exceptions, the bulk of what I read could not compare to what the students were bringing to the workshop at Fresno State. So that was the beginning. There were other classes. There were theory classes. I was really doing a lot of homework. In one class, I think I read, we read 9 or 10 books in one semester. So I was busy. I was busy, but I did enjoy it, especially these were all writers, almost all of them, more contemporary writers, 21st century writers. And that's what I needed to experience, because I realized that even if I walked into a bookstore, we're inclined to look for things you're already familiar with. But here, I had a terrific opportunity to read new writers.
And your thesis, Ghosts of the Genocide, it seems to me you had an opportunity to sort of do an interior review of your life, to go back in early periods in your life and to reconstruct certain periods that impressed you, in other words, are memorable, and many of them deal with the question of identity. And there's one story which is called "What Are You?" from "Ghosts of the Genocide." And if you can read that for us, and then maybe we can talk a little bit about how that worked into your thesis.
All right, I'll do that. Let me get set here. What are you? In 1979, I was a brand new teacher in Fresno, California, my brand new residence. At one of my earliest assignments as a substitute teacher, I walked the aisle, checking the students' work. The floor squeaked near the first row from my desk. The morning sun didn't bother the bank of windows. I knew little about Jaron and didn't care much to spend the entire day promoting them. But the assignment wasn't one I designed, and the ninth grade students were mine only on loan. I thought of subbing as kind of an audition. Mr. Shavor? The girl's voice rose from just two desks away. She had her head on her arm. She appeared to be studying something near her elbow. Yes. What are you? What am I? Usually I told Odars, non-Armenians, that I was Armenian. Although I told Armenians I was Assyrian. I told a few Assyrians I met, who weren't related, that I too was a fellow Assyrian, even though my grandmother was Armenian and all my Assyrian relatives spoke Armenian. Most of the time, though, I felt as American as a hot fudge sundae at Foster Free. "Are you black?" she asked plainly. He sat up to hear my answer. I was 25 at the time. I had been asked, "What are you?" in one form or another for a longer time than I realized. "No." Just a month before, though, a kid had approached me in the laundromat and asked me if I was Franco Harris, the running back for the Pittsburgh Steelers. Franco, the Italian stallion. He was half Italian and half African-American. I smiled big, nodded at the kid, and told him Franco was my brother. He believed me. She tried again. "You Mexican?" I was now a mini mystery at the back of the Scope magazine that the teacher left should the student finish identifying Jaren. "No. I mean, you something. I know you're not white." "What are you? Who gets to decide the import or the impact of that answer? I could tell you that in the United States in the year 1909, the question was taken to court and determined that Armenians were officially declared or reclassified Caucasian and were no longer to be considered Asiatic. And that four Armenians who brought the case were able to stay in the United States because the United States wanted the former, but not the latter at the time. The court of public opinion would maintain a different view of the matter for generations afterwards. But the whole idea that something called a country or more than wants or doesn't want you because of one descriptor or another can throw an entire group of people on a path towards a destination, destiny, a legacy that they could not have imagined, a journey that they had no intention of traveling."
It's a story that I can tell you put a lot of thought into, in the sense of, what does that all mean to be asked, "What are you?" And it's as if the person asking the question has an expectation, right? Because they're asking you by what you appear to be.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, we don't look like, I guess I'm dating myself, we don't look like Ozzy and Harriet, usually. And so people want to know. It's just something we've experienced in the past.
And when did you begin to experience that? When, at what time in your own life did you really get those questions? I mean, she's asking when you're a substitute teacher, but were you thinking about this earlier?
Oh, yeah. When I was in elementary school, this would be fourth grade, so 1964, as far as I knew or cared, I was accepted by my peers. There was no difference between one kid and another, so on and so forth. But one kid realized that he came up to me and said, he pointed at me and said, "Black Jack," and ran away. This was during recess. And I thought, what's wrong with that guy? And then word got around that I had a new nickname, and people were running up to me. And the way they said it suggested that this wasn't a good thing. So I was upset. Didn't like it at all.
Yeah, that's something at an early age to be already categorized and put into some place like that. Now, your thesis also kind of navigates the question of identity, but also in respect to Armenian history and the Armenian genocide. And there's a story that you have which is called "Who Today?" Short one of the sections of your thesis, which looks at you in middle school, and also relates to the genocide. Would you like to read that for us? "Who Today?"
I sure will. Thank you, Barlow. Okay, here we go. "Who Today?" 8th grade, ages 13 to 14, is hellish and impossible to navigate, predict, or understand. My friend John and I gave Miss Niebuhr hell. As adolescents, we were discovering and practicing our power, finding out that there are other far more entertaining things to do other than gaining the favor of adults. There were the standard methods of declaring your nascent individualism: sports, firecrackers, cigarettes, defiance, sarcasm, superheroes, and Mad Magazine. And I was convinced that John's obsession with Nazi Germany was an ironic way of looking at strength and force, a fantasy about accessing power. He consumed books on the topic, drew swastikas on his peachy folder. We were pals, nevertheless. One day after Miss Niebuhr had made us stand for an entire class because we were too rambunctious, John asked me a question on the way out of class. "I'm German, as you may have already guessed. What are you?" "I'm Armenian. I know your people." This was a surprise. There were only two or three Armenians in the entire school. "You do? What does the Armenian flag look like? I'll draw a replica of it." I had no idea. I had never even thought of Armenians having a flag. The next day, he told me he knew what the Armenian flag looked like. "It's the hammer and sickle. Your country is under Soviet rule." He shook his head. I became annoyed. "How do you even know about Armenians?" I asked. "Hitler mentioned them." "What?" It was the first time I had heard the words Hitler spoke in 1939 that showed he never feared retribution for his attempt to exterminate an entire people. Who, after all, speaks today of the annihilation of the Armenians? Adolf Hitler.
That's pretty powerful. First time to hear these words in eighth grade. Had you been aware before that, of course, of the genocide in general?
I did have a notion of it. My grandparents and my great aunts and uncles did not speak about it, but I'm pretty sure. Yeah, you know, in 1965, that was the 50th anniversary, and I can remember our church, you know, talking about it. That may have been the first time that I knew some of the details. I knew there was trouble, but I didn't know what that trouble was.
And you knew that you had heard that through the church. Had you heard about it at all through your own family? Was there anyone that you had?
They would make, they would make vague references. I had no idea what the scale of it was. Just that they were, the church were mistreating the Armenian people, and they had to flee. And I didn't, until I started reading, accounts of what happened specifically, I did not know the bigger picture.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. My guest today is Jack Chavour, and he's finished his thesis at Fresno State with getting his MFA in creative writing through Fresno State. We'll take a break here and come back and continue our discussion and hear some more from his thesis called Ghosts of the Genocide.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Welcome back to All Things Armenian. We were listening to a piece called Echmiadzin Bar, which comes to us from the Chilingirian Quartet, who performed it as part of their CD, which is the Komidas Aslamazyan arrangement of Komidas's music. So some beautiful Armenian music today. My guest today is Jack Chavur. Welcome back, Jack.
Thank you. Good to be here again.
Yes. So we were talking about you being in the MFA program at Fresno State and about your thesis. We were listening to some excerpts from that thesis. But I was interested because earlier you said that you had actually been writing some of these stories before. Is that right, during your time as a teacher?
Well, ironically enough, I wrote very little about the Armenian experience. I've been writing I've been keeping what I write since the 80s. And let's see. What happened was I entered the program thinking I was going to write my thesis about my experiences as a teacher. And with about maybe a year and a half to go, Stephen Church, the department chair, commented on something I had turned in because previously he had said, you know, that a lot of people write school teacher stories, you know, and you ramble and you use too much dialogue. And so I spent that summer a little annoyed, and I said, all right, for the summer, I'm going to challenge myself to write shorter, more compact, and find something else besides school to write about. And originally, I set my goal at 100 words, which is really very, very short. And by the end of the summer, I had 30 of these little compact things, and I looked at them. I said, what do they all have in common? And I said, some of them are a little dark. Because I did write real short things about the Armenian-American experience. So I gathered those up, added a few. And the first time we had a workshop, I said, okay, let's see what he says now. So I submitted it, and the class responded positively. And then Stephen said, this is your thesis. And I was a little surprised. So that's how that started.
And you started with approximately 30 sort of stories. Out of curiosity, how many did you end up with in the thesis? Roughly.
Over 100.
Over?
I think it was 125. I don't know.
Right.
So, yeah. I mean, you know, Grace and I, once we got onto the idea that this was going to be it, my wife, Grace and I, would say, oh, what about the time? Oh, here's another one. And we started taking notes, you know, different stories, because we all, you know, as a community, we have those kinds of stories, you know. And so next thing I knew, I had quite a good collection of them.
And it seems like family is a big part of this. One of your pieces deals with your grandmother, Ruth. Did you get to know her? Did you have a chance to talk with her?
In fact, my great-grandmother, her mother, Hannah, she passed when I was 1962, so I was 8. So I got to know her, except she spoke mostly Armenian, and I couldn't speak Armenian. But yeah, my grandmother was a very influential person in my life, and she passed, I guess I was 23. So I felt lucky and blessed to have her in my life.
Yeah, that's one of your interesting pieces is called Leaving the Very Lovely House. It's an entry from your grandmother Ruth's journal. So if you'd like to read that, I'd like to hear that.
Certainly. Let me find it here. Yeah. Well, last year we were fortunate enough, Grace and I and a group, we were fortunate enough to travel to Turkey and visit our respective towns of our origin. And so we looked for the house. My grandmother had described it in her journal among things that happened in 1895. Leaving the very lovely house, Grandma Ruth's journal entry, May 15, 1966. My childhood. We lived in Hesenek Arpert, Turkey, in a very lovely house, newly built with 11 rooms, outside with white granite. Out of all the years she kept a journal, Grandma Ruth wrote only 2 pages about how they escaped. But when I finally went back to Arpert, some of the puzzle pieces, her life experiences there, and what she passed on to us clicked into place. My grandfather was asked by a Turkish family to bring all his family and store all his valuables and stay at the Turkish house. We were well cared for by this family, whom my grandfather had befriended. They say our core impulses are centered, self-centered, but consider this Turkish family. Didn't they follow their own intuition? Isn't that something good at the core? They grew up surrounded by negative notions of who the Armenian people were and absorbed all the spoken and merely assumed bigoted beliefs about us, and then measured those things against my great-great-grandfather and other Armenians they had met. Don't you think that Turkish family realized what was assumed about Armenians was a lie? Even while they, being Turks, were safe? And that getting involved might diminish their own safety? Yet they chose to risk it, to stand against evil, even against their own people, their own country. Standing against evil is the honorable choice. But I tell you, most of us in the same situation would not have done it. On the day before the massacre, my mother and other members of the family carried most of our household goods over to where we were to stay for 2 weeks. I suppose this was a very hard step to take. My grandmother was 5 years old at the time. My grandma Ruth was a person of faith, and so was her mother, Big Grandma Hannah. They had many hard steps ahead of them, a girl about to turn 5 and her mother. Even if the drapes were drawn during the attack, there were gunshots and screams in the aftermath the next day. Grandma Ruth was a very strong person. Of course, I would rather she would have gained her strength some other way rather than by going through what she did. And not every survivor landed on their feet and kept walking. But I know she would say that the source of her strength was the Bible. I'm thinking of a passage that both Grandma and Big Grandma were familiar with. I lift my eyes to the hill. From where will my help come? My help comes from the Lord, who made heaven and earth. He will not let your foot be moved. He who keeps you will not slumber. But he who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is your keeper. The Lord is your shade at your right hand. The sun will not strike you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you from all evil. He will keep your life. The Lord will keep your going out and your coming in from this time on and forevermore. Psalm 121, verses 1 through 8. Perhaps when I was 6 years old and saw Big Grandma sitting in her rocking chair with her hand on the Bible, she was silently contemplating this dilemma. Why God spared her, but not others? I don't know. That is the question, with or without God, which the survivors dealt with. There's an old idiom that I remember hearing during my college days. No one knows where the shoe pinches, but he who wears it. And another one. Only the bearer knows the weight the sack they carry. There were many other survivors who wrote long, detailed accounts of what happened. Others never spoke of it. But I do know the Armenian expression, the Bible is the breath of God. And certainly that breath sustained Big Grandma and Grandma Ruth and countless many others throughout their ordeal. And again from her journal. Early the next morning, my mother looked through the heavy drapes and saw her mother's house on fire. I remember seeing her faint and fall to the floor, and the lady of the house poured water on her face, and she came to. We walked, Grace and I in Turkey, looking for the house. We walked quite a ways, and I saw that the road was going to dead end. I looked to my left and saw a very big white house, two-story house, that stood apart from the others. This could be 11 rooms, built by the owners, who were accomplished builders themselves, built to last, built so well that, according to Grandma Ruth, a town crier was shouting, "Spare the Sadoyan house!" during the attack, which may have indicated that rather than burn it, some Turkish official wanted to live in it. I stopped. "That's it," I said to Grace. "You think that's it?" I looked at the cracks, the water stains all on the front wall, the overhanging second floor, rectangular windows, biggest house on the block. Maybe that's where Grandma Ruth got her confidence. "Yes, this is it." "All right." I knew Grace was indulging my imagination. "And if it's not, we'll just say it is. We got as close as we could." "Right," Grace said with vigor. And we posed for our picture in front of it, both of us smiling big, triumphant, without doubt for the moment. Maybe someday my great-grandchild will stand in front of the house on Niagara Street in Burbank, California, and say, "This is it. This is where my great-grandfather grew up." She'll be one block away from Catalina Street, where the house actually is. But she'll be right there in the neighborhood. Maybe Belle, the great-grandchild, may just luck out and be standing right on the spot. But this analogy is not accurate. I never had to leave my hometown, my state, or my country, never to return. My father sent word from America. He would never come back. He wanted his wife and child to come to America. It was hard to get a pass. We had to wait 1.5 years. May 1897. We left our grandparents. And we started on our long trip to America with the help of the American missionary. They asked my mother to become a mother to 20 orphan children who were being sent to an orphanage. It was the only way to get a pass. We started on our long trip to America, a very hard, demanding situation. Grace looped her arm through mine, leaned in. We started to walk back to the bus. "How do you feel?" she said, thinking I might feel disappointed. "I feel pretty good." I couldn't think of any other words or any other way to put it. "I mean, it's really something," she said. I felt numb for a moment, but finally was able to attempt a description of how I felt. "Yes. I feel like I have a better understanding of where they were, how far they had to go, what things looked like, and something else, something I don't know how to describe, kind of like a connection." "I know," Grace said, "like completing something." "Yes, that's it." We walked downhill. I noticed shade trees that I hadn't seen on the way up. And I saw more chickens, cats, and dogs roaming free, belonging to no one and everyone.
From The Ghost of the Genocide, leaving the very lovely house, Jack's sort of interaction with his grandmother Ruth, her own memoirs, her own journal entries, and how that all put together was very interesting, because it brings a lot of questions to mind, and we're going to explore some of those questions after we take another break here on All Things Armenian.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Welcome back to All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlo Demirgardichian. We were listening to another piece played by the Chilangarian Quartet. It was called Nubar Nubar, and it was arranged by the Gomidas Aslamazian, by Aslamazian, and it's an original work by Gomidas. So again, some very beautiful Armenian music that we were listening to. My guest today is Jack Chavur. We're talking with Jack about his thesis called Ghosts of the Genocide. Welcome back, Jack.
Thank you.
When we had taken our break just now, we were you had just finished reading one of your pieces called Leaving the Very Lovely House. And it involved your interactions. It was very interesting because it actually, it seems to me, was prompted by this trip that you took to historic Armenia, Turkey. When did you take that trip?
We were there in October of 2019.
So that's fairly recent, right? Yeah, I mean, that's something. And it seems like that sort of impelled you to write about that experience, that sort of reevaluation of your own life and your grandmother's life.
Yes, and it was, I can't even describe it. I was able to take notes while we were on the bus, and I used my thumbs on the cell phone, and we spent a lot of time on the bus, so I ended up with 60 pages worth of notes. And that came in very handy when I got home.
And the story that you told in Leaving the Very Lovely House actually had the story of the Turkish family that actually helped your family. Is that right?
That's correct. I think one of the questions I tried to raise, along with who are we, and the answer is we're very complicated people. We have to extend that and say, and who were the Turks? And was, you know, generally we don't speak well of them. But here in this case, and I'm sure there are other examples as well, that family was able to see beyond stereotypes and the governmental, I don't know what you would call it, propaganda, and see the humanity in all of them. And so I thought that was an important thing to raise.
Yeah, and I think you said something also in there that I'm going to read again. It says, yet they chose to risk it to stand against evil, even against their own people, their own country. Standing against evil is the honorable choice, but I tell you, most of us in the same situation would not have done it. And I think that's really a very powerful statement, considering what's happening in the world, in our country. That it is important to take a stand, isn't it?
Certainly is, most assuredly. And I didn't anticipate where we would be just a short few months after I wrote those words, but they are turning out to be even more important than before. And also just the universal truth that when we see evil, we need to call it out.
Yeah, I think that's very important. Now, one of the other topics that you touch on is the question of Armenians when they were given refuge in the United States. Sometimes they weren't looked on very very nicely, let's put it, as many immigrants are not. And you tell that of that in a story called Uncle Harry Comes Home. And I'd like you to read that story, and we'll talk a little bit about what that implies for about Armenians and about any immigrants that come and came to the United States.
I would be glad to read it. Uncle Harry is my mother's brother.
Mm-hmm.
Uncle Harry Comes Home. World War II ended, and Uncle Harry returned home. He planned on settling down in Fresno, his hometown, since the age of 9, and beginning his own life. Times were good. The Depression was long over. the economy percolating like a fresh pot of coffee first thing in the morning. He looked for a job, but he could not find one. He kept walking into stores, offices, businesses large and small. He stood straight, shook hands, looked people directly in the eye. Every day for a week, another week, a month. Finally, a potential employer told him, "We're not hiring Armenians." And that's the story Dad told me when I was a teenager. I stared at Dad. He didn't say anything for a while. Then he cleared his throat and said, "I told Harry, put on your uniform. Go back there and say, now what am I?"
Story, and really another sort of way of looking at Armenians and others, immigrants that came to the United States. What happened to Uncle Harry? Did he eventually stay in Fresno, or did he leave?
No, he stayed in Fresno and got a job at Sears Roebuck at a time when Sears was prosperous, and worked for over 30 years there.
How did that make you feel when you heard that story from your dad?
I was a little confused because I knew that from our trips, I grew up in Burbank, and when we came to Fresno, there were Armenians everywhere, you know. And I assumed that the Armenians were well received, but there was this whole other, you know, backstory that I was not aware of. So that was the beginning of my understanding of the issues.
And did you learn more about that? Because it was when the Armenians first came in the 1880s and up through probably World War II, as you mentioned, and then a post-World War period, some Armenians and many Armenians were actually discriminated against in terms of housing. And also there was prejudice in terms of hiring. So what else about that did you find out?
I learned while I was living in Fresno. Those very lovely houses on Huntington over here, and you know, between Sunnyside and downtown, Armenians were not allowed to buy those houses, and the owners of those houses were not allowed to sell them to Armenians, African Americans, Hispanics, and I think Asians were also on that list.
Yeah, and you've now been writing. You finished your thesis. What are some immediate plans in terms of other topics to begin to explore? Or did you still have more that you haven't yet produced?
Well, I know that I have 30 years worth of stories about working at Roosevelt, and I hope to one day assemble those. I just have a lot of material sitting, and now I have the new and improved writing skills thanks to the MFA program. And so I hope to get that. And I really would. My next project actually is having this published. So if there are any publishers out there and listening in,
mm-hmm.
you can find me on Facebook.
That's right. Now, one of the thesis was based really on the concept of genocide and actually the massacres of 1895 and 96, which had occurred earlier, in which also many Armenians were killed. People tend to not talk about that period as much. But all of that makes people, you know, because of Turkish denial, the Turkish government denial of the genocide, the question of, you know, how to bridge the gap between Turks and Armenians is a topic that's often discussed in the Armenian community. And you touch upon it in a story that you had called The Apology. And I was wondering if you could read that story for us, and then we'll talk a little bit about this question of how do Armenians and Turks, if they can, bridge this gap?
I would be glad to. We were, 4 or 5 years ago, we were invited to a friend's house, and he had invited 50 Armenian Americans to hear this person speak. And he had a, you know, shish kebab and all this wonderful food. And here we go. Word was going around that the Turkish man at Yakup's house wished to apologize to us for the genocide. None of us had ever heard of such a thing. This man's conversion to Christianity wasn't a requisite. But in any case, I was interested in hearing what he had to say. He said he was sorry that his people, his country, his government had caused unspeakable suffering and loss. And he asked us to forgive him. His eyes, face, voice, and hand gestures belonged to a man who was sincere. I was born and raised in Burbank, California, grew up eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, rode my bike all around town, built model airplanes, drove a 65 Impala to see Bob Dylan in concert at the Fabulous Forum, played pickup basketball games all day on Saturday, clerked at 7-Eleven on the graveyard shift in North Hollywood, tossed empty bottles of Michelob off of dormitory balconies at my friend's college in Eagle Rock, drove to Tommy Burger in the valley on my way to Santa Monica to watch people roller skate or do drum circles or play beach volleyball. Sometimes I even swam in the Pacific Ocean. I haunted used record stores run by hippies in Hollywood, sold peace buttons at the Rose Parade, took in the view at Mulholland Drive, sometimes just by myself. Grace and I spent weekends up and down the California coast. When the kids came along, we hiked down to Crater Lake, took a boat ride, got soaked, lost hats. We saw a play on Broadway in New York, ate fresh pineapple in Maui. I tell you, if I got dropped off in Armenia and couldn't come back to the United States, I would be homesick for the rest of my life. But when that man, a man I didn't know and probably won't see again, stood in front of 50 Armenians and apologized for the massacre of innocent Armenian people and asked us, survivors of the genocide, to be forgiven, I began to cry, and I was not alone. Grace and I accepted his apology, and I felt something that I cannot describe, a kind of lightness moving through me. And when Grace touched my arm, I felt that same lightness moving through both of us. We were not all in agreement, though. Some of my Armenian brothers and sisters stood with their arms folded across their chest, occasionally waving a hand or tipping their heads back, frowning throughout. For them, dinner had been spoiled. I heard the words from more than one person, "Sude! I don't believe him. He's a liar." Grace and I believed him, though. We thanked him, too. I admit, though, it is easier for us 100 years later to say, "I forgive you." And I don't know how many back then, about to die, repeated the words of Jesus, "Forgive them. They don't know what they're doing."
Yeah, that's a it's another powerful piece because it really explores the human, I guess the way human beings look at things in the world, and it seems like a topic that you've spent quite a bit thinking about.
Yes.
Tell
us. We had many opportunities to think about it, and it's all part of the idea of these are ghosts that haunt us and sometimes trouble our mind, things that we carry. We don't we don't want to be mopey, and we do live our lives. But those notions are there, wondering.
And that's really where your ghost of the genocide comes from. Then,
it's this. That's correct. Yeah.
Right. And was this towards the end of your towards the end of the thesis? Then, this piece.
let me see. No, actually, near the end of the piece, we're in Turkey, and so my, you know, it's like completing this journey, going back to where everything started.
Yeah, this is a powerful piece. I'm very happy to have had today as my guest Jack Chavur. Again, his thesis entitled Ghosts of the Genocide was nominated by the MFA program as the outstanding thesis in the College of Arts and Humanities. It is a powerful set of pieces. We look forward, Jack, to seeing this published very soon.
I'm working on it.
You're working on it. Great. It's been great today to have as my guest, Jack Chavur, and want to thank all of you for joining us today, listening in on our episode of All Things Armenian, and we'll see you next week for another episode of All Things Armenian.
Tune in to All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
This was a special program on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Este fue un programa pagado y solo refleja la opinión de sus anunciantes. Ahora continúa disfrutando de la programación de 1600 AM.